Review, Analyzing Australian Imperialism. Clinton Fernandez, Sub-Imperial Power, Australia in the International Arena. Melbourne University Press, 2022. The central issue in world politics today is geopolitical competition between the United States and China in the Asia-Pacific region. The Australian state is one of the US's strongest supporters in this contest, a stance publicly justified by the supposed threat posed by China to democracy and human rights. Challenging this narrative and understanding why Australia ACTS in concert with its superpower ally is a priority for anyone opposed to imperialism. Clinton Fernandez's book Sub-Imperial Power is a welcome contribution to these efforts. Fernandez has a background in military intelligence and as an academic at the Australian Defence Force Academy. But in this book he dismantles many of the foundational myths of Australia's security establishment and opposes the imperialist logic which is making the prospect of war between the US and China ever more likely. Short and accessibly written, this is a book aimed at influencing public discussion rather than academia. But nor is it really a work of the political left. Fernandez doesn't engage with theoretical debates about imperialism and his lack of a clear political framework reduces the book's usefulness for socialists. Fernandez's central contention is that Australia is a sub-imperial power. It is subordinate to the imperial center, that is the United States, defends the imperial order known as a rules-based international order, and projects considerable power and influence in its own region. P.21. As a first approximation, this analysis has a lot of merit. Clearly Australia and the US are not equals. The United States is the world's sole superpower and when it comes to conflicts in the Middle East or confronting China, Australia supports the US rather than going it alone. But Fernandez does not slide into a simplistic anti-Americanism, which sees the Australian state as betraying its own national interest in the service of the US. In short, Australia is not a victim of this imperial order but a junior partner and enthusiastic, if anxious, supporter. P.16. He argues that Australia has generally benefited from the US-centered international order. Although not really a focus of this book, Fernandez also touches on Australia's own dominance of small regional nations such as Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands and East Timor. This is a step forward from left nationalist analyses which have long been prevalent on the Australian left. But nor does Fernandez completely avoid the problems associated with these positions. The strongest part of the book is its critique of the so-called rules-based international order, which is the constantly repeated rallying cry of the US and allies like Australia in their confrontation of China. They claim to be defending a neutral set of rules which benefit all countries, in accordance with established international legal norms. Fernandez rightly exposes how these claims serve to legitimate the US and Australia's own interests. The international order established after World War II was constructed around U.S. economic and financial supremacy, with a banking system centered in New York and the U.S. dollar serving as the global reserve currency. International bodies like the World Bank and International Monetary Fund are constructed along lines dictated by the U.S. The rules establish the rights of private business to invest capital wherever it chooses, with free trade agreements favoring the more developed economies. Of course, liberal economic principles can be abandoned when necessary. A prime example is the current U.S. attempt to limit Chinese access to computer microchips. These are crucial components if China is to develop high-end manufacturing capabilities, including of advanced weaponry. The U.S. has also established a string of military bases and alliances which surround China and threaten its vital trade routes. It's not a threat China can ignore, given the U.S. has repeatedly toppled governments which oppose its interests, either by invasion or by fomenting internal coups. On the other hand, rhetorical commitments to democracy and human rights have never stopped the U.S. forming alliances with friendly dictators. Fernandez rightly argues that the status quo international order has benefited Australia's economy, enabling the export of efficiently produced primary commodities like coal and iron ore. So having coasted in the slipstream of U.S. supremacy since the end of World War II, P.41, Australian policymakers are anxious to see the existing order maintained. Nor can Australia claim any moral high ground in terms of respect for human rights or the right to self-determination, having supported, for example, the Suharto dictatorship in Indonesia and the ongoing occupation of West Papua. Fernandez is, however, too dismissive when he describes the rules-based order as a euphemism for imperial practice, P.58, implying it is a rhetorical nicety which merely disguises a more brutal reality. This obscures how the legal order positively structures international affairs and does so in ways which are not exclusively to the benefit of U.S. capital. The global economy today really does operate for the most part according to liberal norms. Trade patterns are determined by nations' comparative advantages in production. Capitalists from all countries are generally free to invest where they expect to reap the greatest profits. International shipping firms enjoy freedom of navigation. Interactions between capitalist nation-states will always be structured around some form of legal order, mirroring civil society inside national borders. In both cases, legal norms govern the actions of formally equal and independent juridical agents, individual citizens, nation-states, providing the structure in which substantive inequalities, class position of citizens, national economic development are given free rein. But in the absence of an international suprastate, disputes between legally equal sovereign nations always have the potential to be resolved through the use of force. As Marxist theorist of international law China Meville argues, the chaotic and bloody world around us is the rule of law. 2. So Fernandez is right to stress how the rules currently favor the US and its allies, which is why countries like China and Russia seek to restructure them. But to counterpose the rules-based international order with the United Nations-centered international system, underpinned by international law, p.57 wrongly suggests that international law could ever be an alternative to great power rivalries. This points to a general shallowness in Fernandez's understanding of imperialism, which is focused on the overwhelming strength of the U.S. in world affairs and how it treats poorer countries. Quoting historian Michael Doyle, he defines imperialism as a relationship, formal or informal, in which one state controls the effective political sovereignty of others, p.10. This is a trans-historical definition, supposedly applicable from ancient Rome through to today. It is of limited usefulness in understanding the international system under capitalism, which consists of a political sphere of independent territorial nation-states coexisting with capitalist economic development which transcends all borders. No nation is an autarky, independent of international market forces. This doesn't imply a loss of sovereignty, it is the historically unique form that sovereignty takes under capitalism. 3. But equally, the need for each state to defend its particular economic and strategic interests against competitors generates imperialist rivalry. Anti-imperialist theorists have debated how to understand the evolution of the international system since the end of the Cold War. Has inter-imperial competition involving multiple great powers, of the sort which resulted in the two world wars, now been replaced by a single U.S. empire which serves the interests of all capitalists, or which at least effectively suppresses the rivalries of the various national capitals? Or will U.S. dominance, which was never complete, eventually be challenged by new rivals? 4. Fernandez doesn't engage with this debate, which means he never clarifies how the interplay of sovereignty, capitalism and imperialism generate what we know as the world order. This results in two important ambiguities running through the book. First, Fernandez does not clearly state whether or not Australia has suffered a loss of sovereignty to the US. This is a crucial issue, since he goes so far as to argue that a nation's sovereignty can be diminished due to collaboration between both countries' elites, p.3, an extremely broad conception. Whether Australian interests are subordinated to those of the US, and if so, why the Australian state and capitalist class would pursue such a policy, is never resolved. At times, Fernandez stresses the benefits of the U.S. alliance for Australian businesses. But he also implies that substantial U.S. investment in Australia, particularly in the mining industry, has altered Australia's stance towards China in ways which are detrimental to Australian capital. He also critiques the Australian economy as being wealthy but dependent due to its lack of complexity, focusing on the export of raw materials with little manufacturing with vital sectors integrated into the value chains of US corporations, p.22. But if Australian capitalists have pursued economic integration with the US, this needn't imply an infringement on Australian independence. It has simply been the most profitable alternative available to them in the global economy. Fernandez acknowledges that Australian governments have provided the US with military support because of strategic calculations, not for sentimental reasons or because they were duped, p.35. Yet he also bemoans a lack of Australian strategic independence, claiming that the aim is to uphold US military dominance, hence the deliberate choice not to develop a separate Australian military strategy, p.29. This should not be a concern for anti-imperialists. Instead, we should focus on how the U.S. alliance serves to enhance Australia's own power. It secures the backing of the world's strongest military and offers access to advanced weapons like the latest aircraft, missiles and now submarines. Without the alliance, the Australian ruling class would probably develop its own nuclear weapons and would certainly be forced to spend far more than the current 2% of gross domestic product on the military. 5. an independent Australia would also continue dominating smaller regional countries. Fernandez rightly denounces how Australia has meddled in the affairs of post-independence East Timor, spying on its government and seeking to deprive it of revenues from oil deposits in the Timor Sea. But he fails to mention how Australia's military intervention in East Timor in 1999 laid the basis for all of this. Fernandez has argued previously that popular pressure forced a reluctant Australian government to save the new nation from Indonesia. 6. In reality, Australia deliberately used its military power to control the transition from Indonesian rule, defending its own strategic and economic interests. Australian intervention was certainly an independent action, towards which the US was initially ambivalent. It was also a prime example of Australian imperialism. Ultimately, Fernandez's use of the term sub-imperial doesn't clarify the analysis of U.S.-Australian relations. Whatever the particular term employed, it is important to understand that the Australian state is an imperialist power in its own right, seeking to defend as best it can the Australian capitalist class's own specific interests against rival powers. In this context, the U.S. alliance has proven immensely beneficial for the past 8 decades, offering a security guarantee while enabling Australia to carve out a profitable position within the circuits of international capitalism. The alliance no doubt involves unwelcome trade-offs at times, and it might cease to be beneficial in future if U.S. hegemony is undermined by Chinese competition. But it has been rationally chosen by those who exercise power in Australian society. The second ambiguity is whether Fernandez sees China as a new imperialist competitor to the US or a potential leader of anti-imperialist challenge from the Third World. At one point he refers to the global confrontation between developed and developing countries, between North and South, between imperialism and anti-colonialism p.106. It isn't clear how China's economic rise and challenge to US geopolitical hegemony in the Asia-Pacific fits into this picture. Fernandez certainly does not join the ranks of those who for whom anti-imperialism simply means opposition to the US, even to the extent of supporting the expansionism of China or Russia. But nor does he clearly oppose the authoritarian capitalism championed by the Chinese Communist Party. Although acknowledging repressive aspects of the Chinese state, particularly in Xinjiang, Fernandez presents a generally benign view of China's international role. Its economic growth has been achieved without resorting to slavery, war or colonialism p.76. And although China does not seek to impose its domestic order on other countries except Taiwan, poor nations could see its development model as an attractive alternative to failed neoliberalism. With tensions between the US and China rising, we should unambiguously reject supporting one side or the other. Perhaps Fernandez would agree. His concluding chapter is tantalizingly titled, "Neither Their War Nor Their Peace." But he can't point to any real alternatives, merely suggesting that Third World countries might be attracted to a policy of non-alignment, advanced through motions passed at the UN. A democratic, equitable, international order would be an alternative to an imperial order whether led by the United States or a China-based alliance system. pp. 125-26. This is utopian liberalism. It fails to see that since imperialism is the necessary outgrowth of capitalism, great power rivalry is inevitable unless its economic basis is overthrown. In relation to Australian domestic politics, Fernandez adopts a vaguely populist position, in which the interests of the elites are at odds with those of the public. It's hard to disagree that for those who want to challenge Australian foreign policy, the task is to change the domestic structure of power p.121. But who might have the motivation and power to effect this change remains a mystery, let alone what alternatives they should be seeking. It is to Fernandez's credit that he has written a book which challenges the anti-China consensus of mainstream commentary on international affairs. He offers a stinging critique of how the US and Australia deploy the rhetoric of the rules-based order to justify their own imperial maneuvers. But an effective anti-imperialist politics needs to be grounded in a clearer understanding of how Australian capitalism generates distinctive imperialist interests for the Australian ruling class. References. Kalinicus, Alex 2009, Imperialism and Global Political Economy, Polity. Fernandez, Clinton 2004, Reluctant Saviour, Australia, Indonesia and the Independence of East Timor, Scribe Publications. Kuhn, Rick 1997, The Australian Left, Nationalism and the Vietnam War, Labour History. 72, May. https://www.jstor.org/stable/27516471. Meville, China 2005, Between Equal Rights, A Marxist Theory of International Law, Brill. O. Lincoln, Tom 2021, 2014, The Neighbor from Hell, Two Centuries of Australian Imperialism, Interventions. Peach, Sam 2010, Australian Imperialism and East Timor, Marxist Interventions. 2. https://southaustralia.org.au/me/2/2.htm. Rosenberg, Justin 1994, The Empire of Civil Society. Verso. Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, 2022, SIPRI Military Expenditure Database. https://www.sipri.org/databases/malex.